Okay, so get ready to dive into some seriously fascinating stuff. We're talking Kabbalah, specifically a text called the Talmud Esser HaSfira. Basically, it translates to the doctrine of the Ten Sfirot. It's like, like a map of how reality is structured, at least according to Jewish mysticism.
It's a pretty intense read, yeah. But that's what we're here for, right? Break it all down. This text is really essential for understanding Lurianic Kabbalah, which, if you don't know, is a system of Jewish mystical thought.
So no pressure or anything, right? Just explaining the secrets of the universe, no big deal. But seriously, where do we even begin with something like this?
Well, you've got to start at the source, right? And
Yeah.
in Kabbalah, that's Ein Sof, the infinite. Imagine going beyond like our typical ideas of God, even
Yeah.
beyond limitations, beyond duality. That's the realm we're talking about.
Okay, so we're talking beyond space and time, beyond good and evil, beyond any categories we normally use to make sense of things.
Exactly. Ein Sof is, how do they say it? Simple. Meaning it's totally unified. Think of it this way. In our world, we see things as separate, light and dark, sweet and sour, you and me. But in Ein Sof, all those opposites, they're actually unified. They just exist as one reality.
Whoa. Okay, that's a serious mind bender. So you're telling me that the most fundamental level of reality, a sweet and sour are the same thing? I'm gonna need a minute to process that one.
It's a lot to wrap your head around, for sure. But it makes you think, doesn't it? Like, what else are we getting wrong because we're stuck in our limited way of seeing things?
That's a really good point. So we've got this ultimate source, this Ein Sof, which is everything, right? But then how did we get from everything being one to, well, everything? How did this whole creation thing happen?
That's where Tsimsum comes in, which
Yeah.
means contraction.
Yeah.
But, and this is important, keep in mind, this isn't a physical squeezing or shrinking or anything.
Okay, good. Because I don't know, I was kind of imagining the universe doing some kind of cosmic crunch, you know?
No. It's more like a withdrawing, a concealing of the infinite light of Ein Sof. Imagine, if you will, a single point within this boundless light where the light dims, creating a kind of void.
So are you saying that creation begins with a kind of emptiness?
Exactly. It's within this empty space that the stage is set for creation to begin. But, and it's a very big BUT, it's not just empty, there's structure here. Think of it like this: the text talks about four stages or levels that emanate from Ein Sof into this void.
Four stages. So it's not just a sudden poof and then everything appears. There's a process here. What are these stages like?
Well, they're represented by the four letters of the Hebrew name of God, YHVH, often transliterated as Yahweh. Picture it like this: imagine pouring water into a series of bowls, okay?
Yeah.
Each bowl represents a stage of creation.
Okay, I'm with you so far.
So the first bowl, the one closest to the source, that one holds the purest, most refined water, right? But then, as the water overflows into the next bowl, it becomes slightly denser, just a little further from its original state. And so on, until you reach the final bowl, which represents our physical world. Each stage represents a progressively, denser or coarser level of creation, moving further away from that initial unity of Ein Sof.
That's actually a really helpful way to visualize it. So it's like each stage is a step down from this pure light of Ein Sof, becoming more defined, more material, more separate, until we get to, well, us. Rocks, trees, everything we experience with our senses.
You got it. But here's where it gets even wilder. The text describes a kind of spiritual recipe, for how things come into being. Within each of these four stages, there are four phases that need to occur. It's like following a cosmic cookbook or something.
Okay, now you're speaking my language. Give me the ingredients for existence.
Well, the key ingredient, the driving force behind it all, is this concept of a desire to receive.
Desire to receive. I mean, like, I want that chocolate cake and I want it now. That kind of desire.
Kind of. But on a much grander scale, you see, it's this desire to receive that creates the very vessels, what we call kelim, that can then receive the divine light. So think of it like this: each of us, we're all born with a unique set of vessels and our capacity for experiencing joy, love, creativity. It all depends on how much light our vessels can hold.
Wow, that's a really interesting way to think about it. So you're saying that our very existence, the fact that we can experience anything at all, is because of this fundamental desire to receive. That's a pretty big deal.
It's huge, this desire to receive.
Yeah.
It's the basic building block of creation, according to Kabbalah. And what's really fascinating is that the text gets really specific about it. It even talks about different levels and expressions of this desire and how they actually shape our reality.
Okay, now you're talking. We're talking about the building blocks of reality here. We definitely need to unpack that more. Because it sounds like this desire to receive is key to understanding not just how creation happened, but also why it happened and, you know, our place in it all, right?
100%. And it's not as simple as it might sound at first either. Understanding the nature of this desire,
mm-hmm.
how it can be directed, how it can be refined. It's actually central to the whole path of spiritual growth in Kabbalah. It's a fascinating idea, isn't it? This idea that our desire to receive can actually be a pathway to, you know, connecting with the divine. It's not always easy, though, is it?
Definitely not. I mean, when I think about my own desires, let's just say they don't always exactly scream spiritual enlightenment, you know? So how do we go from gimme to vessel for the divine? How do we make that shift?
Well, the text suggests that a big part of it is about how we approach our spiritual practices. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not enough to just go through the motions. It's about engaging with them as opportunities to connect with something, well, bigger than ourselves.
So it's about intention. Like, if I'm doing something just because I feel obligated, you know, that's one thing. But if I can, like, tap into a deeper motivation, a desire to connect with the divine through that action, that's when things start to shift.
That's the idea. And it doesn't have to be some big dramatic thing either. It can be as simple as, like, you know, really focusing on being more present during prayer.
Yeah.
Or finding meaning in the rituals of daily life.
Okay, that makes sense. It's like those everyday actions become a training ground for, like, refining our desires.
Exactly. It's about bringing those, you know, lofty Kabbalistic principles down to earth and letting them, you know, infuse our everyday experience.
That's actually really encouraging. Okay, but you know how earlier we were talking about how Ein Sof is all about unity, everything being one? Well, we're also talking about how there's this potential for darkness and separation in creation. Those two things seem kind of contradictory, don't they? Help me out here. How can there be separation if everything ultimately comes from Ein Sof?
Yeah, you've hit on a really important point there. It is a bit of a paradox, isn't it? The text suggests that even though everything originates from this place of oneness, there also has to be this illusion of separation. It's like Ein Sof creates a veil, kind of, you know, divine illusion, so that creation can exist as something distinct.
So it's like a cosmic game of hide and seek. But in this game, the hiding is what allows the seeking to exist in the first place.
I like that. That's a great way to think about it. And the thing is, this concealment isn't absolute either. It's more like a filter, letting the light shine through in different ways. You know. So yeah, there's separation, but that connection to the source, it's always there, even if it's veiled or obscured.
Okay, so if I'm understanding this right, this veil, this illusion of separation, that's what makes room for things like darkness. And those klipot forces we talked about earlier.
Exactly. The klipots are like a thickening of the veil, you see. They arise when the creation forgets its connection to the source and gets lost in its own, you know, selfish desires.
So it's like when we forget that we're part of something bigger, we create our own darkness.
That's a powerful way to put it. And it's a trap we can easily fall into, too.
No kidding. But here's something I'm wrestling with. If the light of Ein Sof is infinite, right? And everything comes from that light. How can anything be truly separate from it? It's like trying to have a shadow without a light source, isn't it?
It's a deep question. And it gets at this idea of paradox that's so central to Kabbalah, you know? Even though it seems impossible, the text suggests that even darkness, even the klipot, they exist within the light. Think of them not as independent things, but as distortions of the light's qualities.
Distortions. So like a funhouse mirror, the light is still the light, but it's being reflected in a way that makes it look, you know, warped and strange.
That's a great analogy. And maybe these distortions aren't just random either. Maybe their purpose is to, you know, provide challenges, to create contrast so we can appreciate the light even more.
Wow. Okay. This is making my brain do backflips. So you're saying the light actually creates darkness to reveal itself more fully. That's a pretty wild concept. But it kind of makes sense, doesn't it? Like, we can't truly understand light without experiencing darkness, too.
Exactly. And that's a big part of what spiritual growth is all about, really. Recognizing the paradox, embracing both the light and the darkness, and ultimately using those experiences to transcend the illusion of separation and return to that unity with the source.
This is seriously blowing my mind. Okay, one more thing before we move on. This whole idea that even before creation, within the infinite light of Ein Sof, there's already this potential for desire. How does it even work? I mean, if Ein Sof is complete, how can there be any wanting or needing within it?
You're asking all the right questions. It's a concept that's really hard to, you know, wrap our heads around. The text describes it as a kind of latent potentiality, a hidden seed of differentiation that exists even within Ein Sof.
So it's like Ein Sof contains the blueprint for its own unfolding, even though it's already everything. That's pretty wild.
It really is. And this potentiality, this seed, that's what the Tabalists call the desire to receive. It's not a separate thing, mind you, but a subtle stirring within the light.
So it's like Ein Sof has this incredible potential for creativity, for expressing itself in new ways, and that's where the desire to receive comes in.
You've got, it's like a seed that contains the blueprint for a whole tree, but the tree hasn't, you know, manifested yet. And the contraction of Tzimtzum, that withdrawal of light, that's like planting the seed, creating the conditions for that potentiality to grow.
Okay, I think I'm starting to get it. So even within the ultimate unity of Ein Sof, there's this hidden seed of the desire to receive. And that becomes the basis for creation.
You got it. And that seed, that desire, it's essential for creation to exist as something separate from Ein Sof. It's what gives us our own, you know, unique experience of reality.
This is really changing how I think about the relationship between the finite and the infinite. It's like, we're not truly separate, but rather like expressions of the infinite's potential. That's a pretty awe-inspiring way to look at it.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it has these incredible implications for how we see ourselves and our place in the universe, too. We're not just these random beings, you know. We're connected to something much, much bigger than ourselves.
Okay, I'm with you. So let's dive back into the specifics of this desire to receive. Earlier, you said something about how there are different levels or expressions of this desire. Can you unpack that a bit more for us?
Absolutely. The text explains that the way desire to receive shows up. Well, it kind of depends on the consciousness of the being experiencing it, you see. At the most basic level, it's purely ego-driven.
So kind of like that chocolate cake, I want it now thing, but like on a broader scale.
Exactly. It's about getting our needs met.
Yeah.
Without considering the needs of others, or even acknowledging the source of what we're getting. And that level, that's often where we see those klipot forces pop up. But here's the thing. As we evolve, our consciousness expands. And the desire to receive can actually become more refined.
So it's not a case of bad desire versus good desire. The desire itself can actually evolve.
Exactly. It's all about growth and transformation. As we evolve, that desire, it starts to include an awareness of the source, you see. We develop gratitude for what we receive. And we start wanting to give back, to share the abundance.
So it's like the desire to receive becomes more balanced, less about me, 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 and more about recognizing our connection to everything else.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And that's where true spiritual growth happens, you see. We start aligning with this incredible flow of giving and receiving.
Okay, this is making me think about those four stages of creation we talked about earlier. How does this desire to receive show up differently in each stage?
That's a great question. The text suggests that each of those stages represents a different level of refinement of this desire. The first stage, which is associated with the letter Yod in the name YHVH, that's the most subtle, the most pure. It's a desire to receive that's so close to the source. It's almost indistinguishable from it.
So it's like a pure, unfiltered longing for the light.
Exactly. Imagine a desire fueled by love and gratitude, a deep yearning for connection with the source.
That's beautiful. What about the next stage?
That's represented by the letter He. And this is where things get a little more, you know, defined. The desire is still there, but it's starting to become distinct from the light.
Okay, so a little bit of separation is starting to happen. It's necessary, though, right? Otherwise, creation wouldn't exist independently.
You got it. That separation is key. And then we move into the third stage, symbolized by the letter Vav. And that's where things get even more individualized. This is where the desire to receive becomes about experiencing unique qualities, about exploring individual potential.
So it's like creation is really starting to come into its own here.
Exactly. It's about developing individuality and self-awareness. But of course, with that individuality comes the potential for the ego to, you know, step in. The desire to receive can become very self-centered at this stage.
And that's where we see those clay pot forces showing up again, trying to throw things off balance.
Exactly. And then we reach that final stage, represented by the second letter, He. In this stage, the desire to receive is at its peak of individualization. It's all about the needs and desires of the individual.
And that sounds like it could go either way, towards incredible creation or towards getting lost in those, you know, selfish desires. What determines which path it takes?
That's where the concept of tikkun comes in. Tikkun means correction or rectification. It's about taking that powerful individualized desire and refining it, so that instead of leading to separation, it becomes a channel for the light.
Okay, that makes sense. So How do we actually do that? How do we go about this tikkun process?
Well, it's a multifaceted process. It involves, well, it involves both inner work, you know, mm-hmm. looking at our own desires and motivations, really, and outer action, like how we actually behave in the world. It's about kind of, you know, bridging the gap between our inner world and our outer world. And in doing so, transforming ourselves, but also the world around us.
Okay, that makes sense. But, and I'm not going to lie, it also sounds like a pretty tall order. Where do we even begin?
It begins with, you know, awareness. Start paying attention to your desires, your motivations, really. When you feel the impulse to receive, to acquire, to grasp, just pause for a moment. Just ask yourself, what's driving this desire? Is it coming from a place of, like, neediness, of fear, of ego?
Or is it coming from a place of love, of generosity, of wanting to, you know, share the abundance I've been given?
So, like, becoming more mindful of our internal landscape. Learning to spot the difference between, say, a desire for connection that comes from a place of wholeness versus a desire for connection that comes from a place of, you know, lack.
Exactly. And as you become more aware of those, like, subtle differences, you can start to make conscious choices about how you respond to those desires. You can choose to act from a place of love rather than fear, from a place of generosity rather than scarcity.
Okay, so becoming more conscious of our desires is step one. What comes next? How do we actually start, like, transforming those desires? Action is key. It's not enough to just think about it. You have to actually do something. The text really emphasizes, you know, engaging with the world in a way that reflects the light's desire to give. That means using your unique gifts, your resources, your energy to make a positive impact, to bring more light and goodness into the world.
So it's not just about personal transformation then. It's about taking that transformation and letting it, like, ripple outwards.
Exactly. It's about recognizing that we're all interconnected.
Yeah.
That our actions have an impact on the world around us. Every act of kindness, every gesture of generosity, every moment of, you know, genuine connection, those are all opportunities to bring more light into the world.
That's so inspiring. It makes this whole idea of spiritual practice feel much more, like, expansive. It's not just about, you know, meditating on a cushion. It's about bringing that meditative awareness into every aspect of our lives.
Precisely. It's about living Kabbalah. Embodying its principles in everything you do.
Okay, one more thing I want to circle back to before we wrap up. Remember when we were talking about how the intensity of that, or chastity in the light of mercy, is connected to the strength of our desire to receive? It seems kind of counterintuitive, doesn't it? You'd think that a stronger desire to receive would lead to more darkness, not more light. How does that work?
Yes, that's a great point. And it highlights, you know, how subtle this whole process is. The key here is intention. It's not about trying to, like, get rid of our desire to receive. It's about purifying the intention behind it. Mm. If that desire is fueled by selfishness, by that, you know, me first mentality, then yes, it can lead to separation and darkness. But when that desire is coming from a place of love, from a place of wanting to receive in order to give back, that's when it becomes this incredible force for drawing down the light.
So it's like our desire is a magnet, and the intention behind it determines whether we're attracting, you know, light or darkness.
That's a powerful way to put it. And it reminds us that we have more agency than we often realize. We get to choose what we're putting out into the world. You know, we get to choose what we're attracting into our lives.
This has been an absolutely incredible deep dive. I feel like I've gained so many new insights about Kabbalah, about, like, my own life, even. It's like a whole new world has opened up.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to keep exploring it.
It is a journey of endless discovery, filled with wonder, challenge, and ultimately profound transformation.
Well said. And on that note, I think we're going to have to leave this deep dive here for today. But for our listeners who are feeling inspired to learn more, remember, this is just the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole universe of wisdom out there waiting to be discovered.
That's right. The journey continues. And the most important thing is to approach it with curiosity, with an open heart, and with a willingness to, you know, keep asking questions, keep digging deeper.
Perfectly said. Thank you so much for joining me on this incredible deep dive.
The pleasure was all mine.